said on air from the chair. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Tell all your friends so the show can grow. Take a break and crack a smile while I entertain you for a while. On air from the chair. I said on air from the chair. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show, On Air from the Chair, with your host, Big Mike. I tell you what, my guest today, I am super excited about. You know, the story that he's going to share, I think, will, you know, inspire you. He was able to overcome so much and continues to pay it forward even up to today. So I have so much respect for him sharing his journey. Because it takes a lot of guts to put your life out there. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm excited to, and humbled to have Seth Oswald on the show with me. So, Seth, thank you for daring to take the chair. Welcome to the show, bud.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate you having me, man.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm super excited to learn so much about you because a lot of my guests up until now, I've known or, you know, through someone else I've known. And so you and I think we've seen each other maybe one time in our lives, but so we're really interested. So for us to just kind of get acquainted, why don't we start with just the basics, you know, kind of where you grew up, you know, where you're from, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, man. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio.
Okay.
And I still reside here in the area, and I have three siblings. I have a sister, I have an older brother, then it goes myself, and then I have a sister. And then
the middle child.
So yeah, I'm the middle child. and we're all 2 years apart. We're all summer birthdays.
Oh, wow. So
my parents, it must've got a little cold for them in the fall, winter time.
They're very scheduled people.
That's right. They really are.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, this is where I grew up. Grew up with my siblings. Most of my family's here too. Cousins, grandparents were here.
Oh, wow.
Aunts, uncles. Yeah. Everybody kind of just stayed in this area.
Yeah.
I went to Maumee High School.
Okay.
And now I went away to school for a little bit, went to Miami University, and I came back here, and now I live in Maumee with my wife and my two kids.
Oh, that is too cool. So being from the Toledo area, I do have to ask you one thing. Are you a Buckeye or are you the other team up north?
Buckeye, man. That's a great
one. Okay. I was going to end the interview right now if it was the other way around.
I know, right? I can't believe it.
I don't know if you saw my water.
Dude, let's go, man. Let's go.
Yeah, no, Dallas has a pretty big Buckeye contingent down here. So it's pretty easy to be a fan pretty much anywhere in the United States for them. But I just know Toledo is one of those torn towns where I get if someone had allegiance to it because of the proximity and everything. But I had to make sure before we continued the interview.
That's right. You're right. It is so polarized here, man. Like it is a 50-50 split.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, they even have a store up there, don't they? Where half the store is Buckeyes and then half the store is the other team.
Yep. Yes, yeah. It is. Yes,
that it is too funny. Yeah. Yep. So yeah, my sister and my brother-in-law had lived up there for a long time. You know what I mean? And in Perrysburg, just outside of Toledo. So very familiar with the area, just a great place to raise a family for sure. And now you're married and have kids and stuff.
Yes. Yeah, so I've been married to my beautiful wife, Sam. We celebrated 4 years in August. We have two boys.
Oh, wow.
His name is Atticus, and he just turned 2 years old in September. And then we have a 6 month old, and that is Oakland. He's another boy. Yeah, he just turned 6 months here just a few weeks ago, actually.
Now, are there birthdays in the summer and 2 years apart?
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
You're following the family tradition, right?
I mean, right. I can't, you know, we can't help it. Just can't help it. We do have, I guess they're called Irish twins when you have kids under two, right? Two under two. Yeah. And so, lot of fun.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious. So, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the show was you were nominated to take the chair by someone who knows you. And I reached out and we had a great conversation. So, you know, you know, to me, what this show is all about, or what I'm trying to do with this podcast, is the whole theory is to find the extraordinary in each and every one of us. You don't have to be famous. You don't have to be a celebrity. You don't have to be a sports star. It's the single mom at the grocery store raising three kids. It's, I had a 19-year-old kid on who was diagnosed with leukemia and, you know, fought it and had a bone marrow transplant. He's cancer free today and actually finds out his donor here in about, I think it's another week or something. So really excited about that. So I think with all the negative news that's out there, you know what I mean? What I'm trying to find is not necessarily cookie cutter stories to share with people, but just what makes someone extraordinary. You know what I mean? Even if it's from, you know, something that bad that happened to you and you can get to somewhere around there where, you know, so if you don't mind, share a little bit about your story with my listener.
Yeah. So I, as you already know, I grew up with some siblings, grew up in Maumee, Toledo area. And in school, I just, friends and sports came easy for me in sure. school. And that was something that just really came easy for me. And so with having some friends, you know, I wasn't always the best at probably picking some of the best friends. I'm not blaming friends for this at all because sure. I had the choice. And I would say somewhere between like seventh and eighth grade, I really was that teenage kid that just wanted to live my own life. I thought, you know, I didn't really like authority. I was very rebellious, very just arrogant, prideful, and but very insecure at the same time. And so, you know, my parents drug us to church every Sunday, and I just thought that was the dumbest thing, you know, you could ever do. It was a waste of time. And so I never felt like I really belonged at church, but I always felt like I belonged at school. And like friends and sports, like I said, were my identity. Anyways, with that being said, I remember in about the end of eighth grade, I was introduced to pot, to marijuana. And I was like, yeah, sure, why not? You know, let's try it. And so I started smoking weed when I was about 13, 14 years old. And I remember I didn't get high for the first time, but like a couple more times in when I did, I just remember falling in love with it. It was just like, man, this is what I'm missing. Like, and this is awesome. This is fun. Like, this is great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dude, and I just dove right in. And so with smoking pot, obviously started experimenting with other things and just being around that lifestyle. So I started drinking and popping prescription medication. Just using psychedelics, just trying to get whatever I could get my hands on, you know, even like drinking bottles of Robitussin, like just stupid things that I would do any extreme to try to get high or.
Yeah. So was it a situation where you were kind of, okay. So I understand how I feel when I'm on marijuana. How else can I feel on something else? You know what I mean? It's that desire of, well, maybe that can even take me to another level.
You're absolutely right, man. And so sophomore year in high school, my dad had back surgery and he had a slipped disc and it was a pretty serious surgery that he had to get done. So he was prescribed Percocet and Oxycontin. And I remember I was popping some of his Percocets. Like I was a chronic weed smoker by the time. Like I'm smoking weed every single day before and after school. Like it's just kind of what I did. If I could get away with doing it in school, I would. But I started popping some Percocets. And then I remember one night at dinner, we were all sitting around together as a family at dinner. And my dad was like, I can't take the other pills that they gave me because they messed me up so bad. So that was a brilliant idea in my brain. I'm like, well, I got to try these. Right. And lo and behold, they were Oxycontin. And I didn't know anything really about Oxycontin at the time. Nothing.
Sure.
And the first time that I ended up taking them, they were 20 milligram pills and I dumped them in my hand and there's like three that fell in my hand and I just popped them. It's like nothing because I've been eating Percocet for like the last month and he was just big bottles of them. And as I'm sitting there brushing my teeth in the morning, getting ready to go, you know, off to this like family vacation that we were on, we were up in Frankenmuth, Michigan. I was like, man, I don't know. Those were like pretty small. I think I should do more. And I just popped a couple more in my hand, popped them, went about our day. And about an hour later they kicked in and that was my first overdose. Sophomore in high school off of Oxycontin, had to be brought back, rushed to the hospital. And I was just like, oh, you know, just a whole ordeal with the family and got grounded. And it was like all this stuff.
Was that their first time catching you doing something like that?
First time catching me with harder stuff. So they did catch me my freshman year of high school with weed.
Okay.
But when it came to the pills, that's
right.
You know, that's when it started making sense with my parents going, like, my dad especially going, oh, this is where all my pills are going. Right. You know, like, these are where everything's going. Like, this is why my Percocets are all gone.
Right.
And so I never touched opiates after that until I came home. I went away to college. I still partied. I still was smoking, drinking, doing psychedelics, doing everything I could. Dibble dabble with some cocaine in college. And then I came home from college over a summer break, I was at a party. This was about 4 or 5 years later. I was at a party and somebody introduced me to OxyContin. They had OxyContin there and I took it, and it was everything that I was missing in my life. Like, it just took everything away. It fixed everything, even though, you know, years ago I said I would never do that again.
Right.
And that just kicked it off, man. The race began, snowball effect. I started dibble dabbling with it, like, really quickly. Got the connect from the guy that was at the party, and I just started working with his drug dealer. And I was, you know, then became like maybe a couple times a week to then every day I was going to this guy and I was picking up pills off him.
How much was your daily habit, like, money wise?
Yeah, at first it was probably about $20. You know, maybe, you know, like $20 would last me a while, you know, for several days. And then towards the end of it with Oxys, it was about $300 to $500. I mean, I know that's a vast number, but it was about $300 to $500 a day for Oxys. Now, this is back. Let me rate this back. This is back 11, 12, 13 years ago now.
Sure.
And this is before the big pharma switched OxyContin into where they would gel up, because they started finding out, man, there's a lot of street value to these, obviously.
Yeah.
Grinding them down and snorting them, or people are grinding them down and shooting, you know, melting them down and shooting them up with a needle.
Yeah.
IV using. And so this was before that time. And so there were about anywhere, an 80 milligram pill is what I would find, which we call the big boys. We would get probably anywhere, I think it was like around $50 a pill. For a 30 milligram then. And so I was doing probably about six a day towards the end of my game to lose. Six a day. And at that time I wasn't popping them anymore. I was grinding them down and I was snorting them. So it was about six of them bad boys up my nostrils.
Straight to the bloodstream.
Straight through it. Yep.
Yeah. Lord. Yeah. No, it's, you know, so during this time, as you're getting further and further into it, you know, I mean, was there an internal struggle with you at that point yet? Or was it like, no, I'm doing what I want to do and this makes me feel great?
Yeah, it's a great question. I remember specifically, I was driving home from just copping some pills, and I was starting to do it on a daily habit. And I just had this moment, and I think I just got high, but I specifically remember it, man. I was on Airport Highway driving back after copping. And I just remember having this thought of going, like, okay, I could probably stop now, or I can just keep on going. And I remember having that conscious decision right there alone in my car. I said, I'm just going to keep on going.
Yeah.
There was this internal thing, like this insanity piece of it, where it was like, I was still in control, but I think in that moment I've already lost some control.
For
sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So when did it get the worst for you?
Yeah, I think before I did Oxys, when I told you coming back from that party, I was just in a very dark place.
Yeah,
I just got like suspended from school because I was selling weed at school, and I kept getting arrested, got my door kicked in, got raided, and like just a lot was going on. And so like I was just kind of depressed. I was on probation at the time. And so like when I did Oxys, when I came home that summer, it was like, this fixed me. Like I don't have to worry about anything. Like, man, this is who I be. Like I feel great. So like in a sense, there was already lost control even before I started picking up the OxyContin. But it got really bad for me when I was just running out of money. I couldn't function without getting high, you know. Yeah. I was living with my parents at the time. I was working a job, but my parents, you know, living with them and some of my siblings, my youngest brother and my younger sister, they were the first victims. You know, I lived with them. So I pawned all my stuff off, started reselling it so that I could pick up some dope. And then I would start stealing from them. And so that's when it was, you know, okay, there's definitely something, you know, it's getting bad. Like it's starting to get bad.
Right.
It just continued to snowball from there. That was probably the first signs. When I was just stealing and pawning everything off.
Yeah. That's what so, you know, and so, you know, there's certain things I didn't do OxyContin and stuff like that, but there's things, you know, give me a Rice Krispie treat, I can't put it down. Right.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, all the way down to those little minutia things, but we all have those feelings, you know what I mean? And so, you know, the struggle of saying, hey, you know, I know this is getting out of hand, but I can't control how I'm feeling. You know what I mean? Like I need this because it's going to be worse if I don't get it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, man. It was just, I just couldn't function. You know, I couldn't do what normal people do. You know, I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't use the bathroom. Just the things that take for granted today, I guess, that I can do. I just couldn't function as a normal person. My body literally would not function, and I had to get right before anything, you know. And that was the thing, you know, that's how it was. It was like, I, you know, you're getting high to get right. And then after high, I'm like, okay, how am I going to get my, I'm already thinking about how can I get my next fix, you know?
Right.
And so, it was bad, man. It was
bad. Yeah. No. Yeah. So what happened that helped you finally make that turn? You know what I mean? What was there an incident? Was it, you know, hitting rock, you hear rock bottom, right? Or something happened to you, you found somebody and you're like, you know, I want to change for myself, or, you know, was it other people supporting you? You know, what do you think ultimately brought you around the corner?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, the first time, it was a friend actually of mine came to my parents' house and was like, hey, Seth is like heavily addicted to OxyContin.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to die. I've already overdosed, like that, you know, I've already had an overdose, but like when I overdose, you know, you just think you're, I don't know, for me, it was like, I'm unstoppable. Like that just happened. I'm alive. Like I'm great. I'll never do that again. But then, you know, that may last 12 hours and then I'm back out getting high again.
Right. Well, and plus you're young, you know what I mean? So you think you're invincible when you're young anyway.
You're totally right. Absolutely, man. And so it was a friend that came actually to my parents' house because I was actually still living with them, believe it or not. And just said that to him, like, hey, Seth's going to die. Like, he's heavily addicted to OxyContin. They're like, okay. I mean, we knew something was up, but we didn't know. So that was the first time I went into a detox facility. They approached me. I was like, okay, cool. Yeah, you know, I'll go. I think I had some legal trouble too at the time. Like, there was something going on with like some theft or something. But I ended up going to detox my first time in 2010.
Okay.
I got involved in AA. That's when I realized at this detox, I was there for about 11 days. That I had a problem. I probably have a problem. Like I this is bigger than me. So I got involved with AA, started working 12 steps, got a sponsor. And that worked for about 3 months. And then I ended up moving back in my parents' house at the time. And then that worked about 3 months. And then I relapsed. I picked right back up because things were going good. Relationship with my family was good. I'm holding a job with the tree service. You know, things were good, man. So I'm in control again. And, you know, I'm going to go celebrate.
I won't let it get as bad as it was before. You know what I mean? Just a little bit. Yeah, you know, take the edge off.
And I'm going to go celebrate. And so this time when I went to go celebrate, OxyContins were already gelled up by the time.
Mm.
And this is when I was introduced to heroin.
Mm.
And so then my relationship with heroin began.
Mm.
And it was cheaper. It was easier to use. And so I started picking up. I didn't snort it anymore. I was an IV user. And so that just ended up. And I mean, literally from when I got, when I stopped using 3 or 4 months prior to that, and when I picked up drugs, like it was literally like I started right where I left off.
Mm.
Like, yeah, my tolerance wasn't as high, but I mean, within a day or two, like it was already back up mentally, the emotional, the spiritual, whatever, you know, everything going on, like I was right back where I left off.
You're right.
And so rock bottom, I still had lower to go.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I think that's the hard thing is it's that hunger, you know, I mean, you just can't feed it enough to get it to say, you know, I'm leveled off, because there's always that other plateau you can go to. And it's, you know, it's a beast that feeds itself, you know what I mean? And before you know it, you know, and I keep liking it to really trivial things, compared to what you went through, but it's, you know, the weight is so easy to put on, but it's so hard to get off. You know what right. I mean? And so I can eat right for a month. I'd be, you know what? I can have one cheat day. Next thing I know, I'm eating a whole pizza myself and finishing off with some Rice Krispie treats. You know what I mean? It's, right. It's just, it's nuts how the brain works.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. And it's true. And that was it, man. The beast was, you know, the obsession was back. It was in control. And it was full on, it was full blown. And I started dating a girl. And so, you know, and I, unfortunately introduced her to some drugs and mm-hmm. introduced her to heroin. And, man, we were like Bonnie and Clyde. I mean, we were Bonnie and Clyde running around, and now mm-hmm. I have 2 mouths to feed, not just my own. And so then became my relationship where I started dealing with a guy up in Detroit, Michigan, who was a pretty big dealer at the time. And he introduced me to this stuff called China White, and it was China heroin. And so then I started just buying bulk of him, from him. And, I thought, well, hey, you know what? I guess what could help support our habit, we get high, as we just sell this stuff. And so, mm-hmm. I mean, there was a market. I mean, it was booming. And so we started stepping on it, cutting it, and trying to make a little bit more so that we could make it go further. And, you know, it was purely so we could get high. Right. And I mean, obviously that all runs out. You can't have enough, you know, enough's never enough. And so sure. we would all run out. But through that, man, I was in and out of continued rehabs, psych wards, overdosed multiple times, brought back to life. I mean, I even tried overdosing, tried killing myself. Like, I was convinced I had enough dope and to do it. And I was actually in a Speedway bathroom in February when it was snowing really heavily here in Ohio. And I was convinced it was it. And it was like in the middle of the night, went in there, dude, I fell out and I woke up, and it's like, I couldn't even kill myself. You know, it's like, God, dude, it's like, this is crazy. Failure, man.
Somebody's trying to tell you something, Seth.
Yeah, right. And I just couldn't see it, though, you know. Right. And, I was so deep into it, and just in and out of sober living houses and detox facilities and rehabs. Yeah. And my life went to a stereotypical junkie. Like, I was the stereotypical guy on the street, living on the street at the time.
Yeah.
And you know, it was in December. I actually just got picked up outside the dope house. My ex-girlfriend was running in to cop some dope, and I was sitting outside the dope house, and a paddy wagon and a patrol car pulled up on me. And I mean, I was busted. I had stuff on me. I had paraphernalia, you know, I had it all.
Yeah.
And so they arrested me at the time, and I went to jail. And this was in December of 2009. And I've already been to jail multiple times with multiple offenses.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being in the courtroom or being in the system is not new. You know, I have had that.
Sure.
Anyways, they locked me up, and I got out, and I had nowhere to go after I got out. First place I went to was the dope house, because that's where I knew where I could go.
Sure.
I wanted to do. And it's December, towards the end of December at the time after I got out. And I was living on the street, man. I was living in downtown Toledo. Couldn't even go into Cherry Street really anymore, which is a mission here in Toledo. I wasn't even able to go to the missions anymore because I got kicked out just because of continued drug paraphernalia on me or sneaking in drugs and getting caught. And they just like put me on the ban list.
Sure.
So, man, I was living under the high level bridge in December, January. So, you know, it's not so in Ohio. It's not, you know, it's not like, you know,
it's cold. It's cold. Listen, to be on the streets is nothing to laugh about at anywhere. But you know, there's you know, here in Texas, it's only cold 2 months out of the year.
Right. You know what I mean? Right. Yeah. Right. And that's where I found myself, man. I hit it, and I didn't. You know, I was at this crossroad again, where it's a very scary place to be. Where I like couldn't see myself going the way that I was going anymore, living the life that I was living. But at the same time, I couldn't see myself living without the drug.
Yeah.
And it was just a very, very scary place to be.
Sure. So,
man, it got to like crazy stuff. Just like, well, maybe I'll just go kill somebody. You know, maybe I'll just like shoot my girlfriend, go shoot the dope dealer.
Right.
And, you know, maybe two murderers will put me in prison for life, because I know I could get sober in a you know, in a
you can get food, you can get shelter, you can get clothing. Yeah.
Right. And institutionalized, you know, I could, you know, in something that's like that, I could probably get sober and stay sober and be locked up because I don't want to keep really doing what I'm doing.
Right.
So it was just a very, very dark place. Very, very dark place. And I actually had a friend who I met first time in detox. Come find me, really reach out to me. And he was like, dude, it's time. He literally just sent me a text and just said, it's time. And it's just at that place where I was just like, it's time.
Yeah.
And, so he ended up picking me up and he took me to the Salvation Army.
Okay.
And the Salvation Army, I'm like, you talking about the thrift store? Like, I didn't know that they had rehabilitation center, especially in Toledo.
Sure.
So I ended up going in and checking in. That was Tuesday, January 17th of 2012. And I walked in, same clothes I was wearing probably for the last 3 months, just stumbled in, high as a kite, but I got one last boost before going in. That's where my journey with sobriety, my journey with the Lord began. And so I walked in that Tuesday and I still was debating on whether I was going to leave or not. You know, I still just like, even though I was like, yeah, I'm ready to go in, I just still really wasn't ready. I mean, I was in the darkest spot, you know, in my life. And, you know, after I got out of jail, like I said, that month prior in December, the detectives came and they're like, dude, we have so much on you. Like, you're going to go to prison. Like, you're right. Just accepting that, I'm just like, man, you know, and once, you know, coming to find out, I was facing 8 to 12 years in prison.
Wow.
I didn't know that at the time, but
sure.
I came in, checked in the Salvation Army, and I'm sitting there across the counselor and he's like, do you have any like warrants or anything out for your arrest? I'm like, that's funny, man. I was like, I don't know. I'm like, maybe. I just remember some detectives visited me in jail like a month ago and he called them and there was a, what the heck are those called? Not a most wanted warrant, but there was a warrant out for my arrest.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I missed a court date apparently that I had set. And I mean, they, you know, the cops told me everything.
Like, it was like a bench warrant or something like that.
No, it was on not the most wanted list, but it was on the I was on the most wanted for the marshals in town because I had several high felonies that I missed court for.
Yeah.
And so anyways, over the phone, which he was like, they never do this, but they waived my warrants. They reset my court date for even just sitting in there. And I'm sitting here debating whether I'm going to stay or not.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, they completely wiped everything and reset my court date. And so I stayed and there was actually a guy off the street that was in there at the time and he was 90 days sober. And so like I ran into him that night and I was like, man, this is, you know, that encouraged me. So that kind of helped me go, okay, maybe, you know, gave me some hope. And I'm like, maybe, you know, I could get sober or maybe I can do this. Not even thinking about getting sober, just doing this, you know.
Yeah.
And then the night came and detox started kicking in. And I'm like, oh man, I just debated on going. I couldn't sleep that night.
Yeah.
I had to work Salvation Army. It's a work-in facility. And so I had to work that next morning, just debating the whole time I'm in there, like, man, I don't know if I'm going to stay. Like, I really don't know if I'm going to stay.
Yeah.
And it was that evening, Mike, it was a Wednesday night. We went down to this thing called, it was the Vespa or Vespis. And it was like a church service almost.
Okay.
And at this time, I am very much a bounce back and forth from an agnostic to an atheist. And
Yep,
I didn't want anything to do with any type of higher power or spirituality or anything whatsoever, you know, in that sense. And I just didn't believe in it. Just depends on when you were talk to me. We're standing in this church service and there's this song we're singing. It's a, like a praise and worship. And I have no idea what song it was. And I'm sitting in the back and I just remember in this moment, sometime during that song, it was like, I felt this like fullness that I had, that no high, no drug, no alcohol, no sex, no rock and roll, no Oreo milkshakes, no cigars that have ever given me in my life. Like this fullness that I got to experience, but also like this feeling of like the things I've been doing and like what the life I've been living, like just this, I don't even know how to explain it, but like, and in that moment, I just knew it was Lord Jesus Christ meeting me in that room. And I just remember falling to my knees and I was crying, feeling full, but also like a piece of crap. It's such a weird dynamic. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I just remember in that time just going, okay, God, like if this is you, then okay. And I just like said that, like whispered that, like in a trem, like a, just a, I didn't have money, you know, I was sick and I was feeling great, you know, it was just, and then right after I said that, guys in the program who I didn't even know, like there's 60 dudes in this program.
Yeah.
Come up to me and they're just patting me on the back. And not all of them, I don't know how many it was, but I just remember them saying like, stick and stay, man. Stick and stay, dude. Wait till the miracle happens. Wait till the miracle happens. And I'm just like bawling, like losing it.
I got goosebumps right now. Yeah, so I mean, that's awesome.
Just losing it. And yeah. Felt this fullness and this wholeness that I just can't even explain. And I think then in that moment, there was that mentality for me where I just made that decision of going, okay, I'm going to stick it. I'm going to stick it out. Like however long, at least for today, I'm going to stick it out.
Right. Know? Yeah. Yeah. Fight today, win today. You know what I mean? It's an old one step at a time. You know what I mean? It's very cliche, but it really is fighting it hour by hour. You know, mm-hmm. Like that first night where you're detoxing and, you know what I mean? I've never been through it. You know, I've only seen it in movies and stuff like that. But I mean, from people that I know that have done it, you just feel like absolute death. And just, you know, the pain that's involved with it and everything else. And it really plays with your mind of, man, well, this isn't worth it. If I'm going to feel like this, and you're thinking all the time, and then to have a moment like that in the chapel or wherever you guys were for that service to, you gave me absolutely goosebumps listening to it.
It's wild, man. Yeah. It's wild, dude. And it's just a reminder for me of, man, I don't know, man. If it was up to me, it'd still be out there, you know. It's still probably out there, which, you know, and that's the thing of living with addiction is that is me, though, you know.
Sure.
Like the side is me, and the sober side is me, and so it's dealing with it. And I love it. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, yeah. So moving on now. So you, how do you go about on a daily basis? You know. Do you still have that daily decision to make of, hey, I'm going to walk the right line. I'm going to, you know, focus on and let God lead my way, or has it just become that for you, or is it a daily conscious effort of yours?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'd say it's a little bit of, I'd say it's both, you know, it's still there. You know, it's definitely still there. I was just having a conversation with a lady and she was telling me about her son and how he overdosed and got high. And this was just 2 weeks ago, man. And I remember thinking, first thought that went in my head was, dang, where was that stuff when I was out there?
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's still there. Like, it's still a part of me. Sure. And, you know, like, what I love is to struggle forward, you know? And, like, so I think the further I've gone from the absence of using, maybe, like, just, I don't want to say that more I forget, like, how it was or the easier it is. I don't even want to say that either, but
sure.
It is, man. It is the conscious decision every day. Mm-hmm. I'm not biting at my teeth or biting at my nails. Like, gosh, I don't want to get high today. Like the obsession is gone, which is great, but all that's still there. That stink, that I call it stinking thinking, is still there. You know, the dreams, I'll get dreams of using, you know, just like even casual using, like drinking at a party or something like that. Like, right. It's just like, so it is still there. And I look at that as an opportunity of just going like, this is where I can't rely on myself. Like I obviously have to rely on something greater than myself because I mean, drug addiction is greater than myself. Like it is a beast that I can't control. It controls me. And so therefore I need something that is greater than drug addiction. And that's really been my personal relationship with God and the Lord. And leaning into that, I have a great accountability group, you know, and so when I do have those thoughts or those dreams or just anything like that, man, I just have a place where I can go and I can share it with people because I have to, you know. There is this fear of like, I don't want to pick up because I know who that guy is. I know who that is, and I don't want that. I don't want that life
anymore. Oh, yeah. Well, and especially now you got a beautiful wife and kids, and you know what I mean? So it's, you know, you start living for others as well as yourself. making the right decision. So what are you doing nowadays? Like as far as work and stuff like that, what are you up to these days?
Yeah, so I'm a pastor at a church here.
Okay.
I'm a pastor here. I work with in adult ministries, and so I actually get to oversee our Celebrate Recovery, which is our recovery program, our small groups, and then also some of our adult serving teams. And so I get to be a pastor here. I volunteer my time still at the Salvation Army with working with some of the guys who are coming into the program, and just sponsoring them, taking them to meetings, lunch, coffee, whatever they need. So just having that relationship there where I'm helping somebody, but really, you know, in turn, like, it's crazy. Like, I think they help me more than I help them, you know?
Oh yeah.
And, just kind of part of how that is. And just staying involved. Like, I just stay involved with people, trying to give back as much as I can, you know, serve as much as I can, get out of myself, that whole piece. Growing in my relationship with God. So I have personal meditation, prayer, journaling, that I really try to hang on to as much as I can, you know. I really try to hold that as much as I can, you know. And with life getting busy for me, I know when life gets busy, it's like the things that are good for me are usually the first things that go on my schedule, you know. So it's like that personal time, that meditation, checking in with a sponsor or my accountability group, or spending time with my wife, quality time, my kids. Like, it's like as my schedule gets bigger, it's like these are what, you know, suffer first. And, you know,
it's a constant struggle, you know. And I was trying to think of, so it's, I mean, it's been 10 years 10 years and 8 months or whatever it's been. So are you still friends with that friend that came and got you and said, hey, it's time to go?
I am. Yeah.
Are you?
I am. Yeah. We're still really good friends. I know his wife and his kids. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And he knows, you know, my family, but yes. Yeah. We're very close.
Oh yeah. 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 Well, to be able to, you know, share, your story, you know, the hopes of doing something like this is that someone hears this that really needs it. You know what I mean? And so I grew up Catholic, you know what I mean? So I went to Catholic grade school, Catholic high school. You know, I even went to military college. So I was very structured through my schooling. And as an adult, I moved away from the church a bit, you know what I mean? And I've always believed in God, you know, but I felt like, well, I don't need a vessel. You know what I mean? My relationship is here. You know what I mean? It's, I don't need someone else helping me do it. Yeah. And you know, the whole Catholicism thing of, you know, the way the priest was set up and stuff. It wasn't until I got to Texas where we ended up going to a church around here called Hope Fellowship. And the pastor there blew me away, because he was an average guy. It was just like, he can relate to me. Like, he can say, okay, here's the scripture and here's what it actually means. You know what I mean? Like here's how you can equate it to today and how I deal with my wife, how I deal with my kids, and I'm flawed. You know what I mean? I'm not this supreme being. So it really gave me renewed hope. And so for someone like yourself, I mean, that's what I love about where we've gone with worship these days, is that it's about, you know, being available for the people to find you that need that type of interaction, you know, because I've learned so much more about it than I did for my, you know, 18 years of growing up in the, you know, the Catholic calisthenics on Sundays.
Absolutely, man. Yeah.
Yeah. So how big is your church out there?
So we are, I'd say we're probably around 6,000 right now.
Oh, wow.
Attendees that we have on average. COVID changed a lot of things. I mean, it changed a lot of things for everybody, and especially for the church realm. But so we're about 6,000, and we have 6 locations.
Oh, wow. Okay. So all around Toledo?
All around the Toledo area, and then we have one down in Findlay, which is about an hour from here, but relatively all close.
Yeah. And do they do remote services at the satellite, or does each church be self-contained parishioners and stuff?
Good question. It changes. Mostly what we'll do is it'll be from one location where they'll do the teaching will be live from one location. It'll be satellite to everything, but everything else will be live. So the music, the worship, you know, announcements or whatever we got going on.
Yeah.
All of that is separate. But and then every once in a while they give it to the campus so that the pastors at the campus can preach and, you know, several weekends of the year. But yeah, for the most part, it's broadcasted out.
That is awesome. So I am going to ask you one question, kind of just off topic, because I ask everybody the question and I really don't know why. I just like people's answers to it, because again, I don't prepare anybody for these things. And so see how quick you are, Seth. But if a movie was made about your life, and who would star as the leading actor of Seth? Like, who would be the actor that plays the leading role of you? And what would the title of the movie be?
It's a great question. So I've been told by several people I can, depending on the beard or the way I look, maybe I can look like Chris Pratt every once in a while. So I probably would go by that to try to make the looks, right? Yeah. Right. He's much better looking than I am. And way more sharper than everything else.
People always confuse me with Brad Pitt. So, I know what I mean? That's, I get it. You know,
yes, I get it. Yeah. See, so you totally understand. So it'd be Chris Pratt, I would say. And title of my story or title of the movie. That's a great question. I'm thinking of like maybe The Journey or The Grand Adventure. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm in the Lord of the Rings right now too. So that could be it.
Okay.
I'm rewatching and reading the books. And,
right.
So maybe The Grand Adventure, because it really has been an adventure.
Yeah. And, it, you know, and so, you know, what I'll kind of sum it up with is I'm a firm believer that there are no coincidences. You know what I mean? It's as I'm in the weeds and I'm going through something, I may not understand it. But my faith is that once I get through it, I'll understand why I went through that journey. You know what I mean? And so, I'm married to a beautiful woman. I've got two kids, they're in college. And as I was going through my journey to get there, there were times in my life, I'm going, what am I doing? Like, why is my life this hard? But this led me to that, which led me to this, which ultimately led me to where I was supposed to be, which is now and today. And I'll have more issues and journeys to go through in the future. But having that faith of understanding that even when I'm lost and I'm wondering why it's happening to me now, I have that faith that I know that in the future, I'll come to the understanding of why I had to go through that to get to where I'm at. So, to me, your journey encapsulates that so much. And again, I can't tell you how humbled I am for you to come on and share it with me, and how much respect I have for you and the utzpah that it takes to be able to put that out there. You know what I mean? In the hopes that someone hears it and kind of, you know, identifies with it and understands that, hey, you know, that end result is out there for you too.
Absolutely, man. 100%. And they can, people can, you know, people can do it. It is a reality. You know, I think I heard this all the time, you know, which is true, but also it's disheartening, you know, the reality of somebody that has an addictive issue of alcoholism or drug addict, you know, the reality is either death, institutions or prison, you know, or jail institutions or death. And it's like, man, we rarely talk about, well, sobriety, you know, the freedom from it, you know, there is, and it is a beautiful journey, man. It is a beautiful journey, and it's all glory to God that I give. I mean, I'm not here because of, you know, any grand thing that I'm doing, man. I'm just a drop in the bucket. And, you know, and he's the one who has really brought me to where I believe where I'm at today. And so all glory to him. And, just the people that he has put around me, and I call them true friends. You know, they're the guys who tell me the truth, who tell me what I don't want to hear, but what I need to hear.
Right.
And sobriety is possible, and it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So what I found is a lot of times when I'm interviewing somebody, we'll get a lot of listeners in that generalized area. So if someone is struggling, like right now, what would be your advice? Like, what would be the one step to take today? If you're listening to this somehow and you're like, you know what, this is, I need some help. You know, what would you coach them on doing?
Yeah, that's great. I would say if they have somebody that they trust, if they know anybody that they could trust, that they could tell them. I mean, the first step is always to admit. It's always mm-hmm. to have that, like, okay, I have a problem. Like, there's mm-hmm. definitely something going on. And if you're in that place to where you're questioning whether you're an addict or not, if you're picking up and you can't stop and you're not able to stop or you're continuing to obsess, I mean, that might be a sign. But first step is to really just to come to that admittance of, like, I got something going on. And it could be to reach out to a good friend of theirs. It could be a family member, a spouse, somebody that they have, that then it would be to go get help. So mm-hmm. it could be detox facilities all over the map. I mean, they're popping up like mushrooms, you know, like in the spring. Like, there are detox facilities now, rehab facilities that are coming up. And so it would be to call one of the places. You could call a hospital. Mm-hmm. You could call, I don't know what, you could call even 911 and even ask, like, if I have no idea who I should call.
Sure.
You can even Google some places on, you know, your phone or on your computer and mm-hmm. see what they have. And that would be the step that I would encourage somebody to take, would be to go get help, because you can't do it alone. You're going to need a safe place to be able to detox, to get rid of the drugs or alcohol, whatever's in your system, to have some people around you to do that, mm-hmm. to get away from the cycle of addiction that you've been doing, and to give yourself, to break that cycle a little bit so you can get clear-headed.
Mm-hmm.
Taking that step into some type of facility would be wonderful. And if you're like, well, I don't have insurance, I don't have a place like that, there are places that do take you without insurance.
Mm-hmm.
There are facilities that will take you in without insurance and still give you the treatment that you need.
Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, because I think someone just gets that point, and it's that self-worth is so low. And it's like, you need to get those drugs out of your system so that you understand that you actually matter. You know what I mean? And you matter to the loved ones around you. I don't care how alone you feel, there's someone out there that loves you. You know what I mean? And even if you can't identify them, you know, I was telling that 19-year-old kid that had cancer. I saw his post on a Facebook thing, and I didn't know him from Adam. And I said, listen, I normally don't do this and you don't know me, but just know that there's strangers out here that are praying for you, that love you, that, you know that you can do this. So, you know what I mean? Find someone that, you know, yes, but understand that there's, you know, we all want you to be better and feel better and all that kind of stuff. And, God puts people in your life for a reason, and hopefully someone listens to this and really identifies with you and your story, and that gives them that hope to ultimately down the road find that faith.
Absolutely, man. And that's the thing, dude, there is hope. You know, as long as you have air in your lungs and you're still breathing, mm-hmm. like, you can still do it, and you can still get sober, you can still rock and roll no matter what you've done, or no matter what has been done to you, there is hope. And, you know, through the journey, and there's so many different programs that are out there, and churches and places that, you know, even going to your local church, if there's a local church, if you're like, there's no rehabs, you know, stopping at a local church and seeing what they have or what they recommend. I mean, they would, you know, hopefully, give you the place. And
take you point you in the right direction, or help you with some resources to find the right place. Yeah, for sure. Well, Seth, thank you for taking time. I could sit here and talk with you for hours on end, but you've been very gracious with your time away from your family. But again, absolutely humbled to get to know you more. Look forward to continuing to get to know you. Hopefully we can continue this off of the interviews, but just thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, and we'll get this thing broadcast out and try to hit as many people as we possibly can.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it, Mike. And thanks for letting me be on here, man, and tell the story, you know?
Oh, no. The pleasure is all my, and again, people are working at higher levels. So for some reason, this needed to happen, you know?
Hey, absolutely. 100%, man. And I appreciate you, and I appreciate your platform and giving me the opportunity to share.
Absolutely. Really
what God is doing. So it's pretty awesome.
All right. So ladies and gentlemen, how about that episode? Seth, thank you so much for coming in, talking about an inspiring story that you shared with us. Listeners, if you or somebody you know is suffering from addiction, down in the description to the actual show, there will be a link for the National Crisis Center. So feel free to check out that information for more. If you can't find something, shoot me an email and we will get you to the right place. But again, Seth, thank you so much to be able to share your story the way you did, uncensored and just raw and real. Was so absolutely inspiring. So I want to thank you for that. And listeners out there, listen, like the show on Apple, Spotify, wherever. Give us a rating if you can. And leave us some suggestions or notes on our website. I can't leave any episode without asking you one last question. Who dares to take the chair? Will it be you